Ecclesiastes 4. Again, I saw the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed. They had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead, who were already dead, more fortunate than the living, who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been, and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Then I saw that all toil and all skill in work comes from man's envy for his neighbours. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after wind. Again I saw the vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches. So he never asks, "For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure?" This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone, and when he falls, has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm, but how can one keep warm alone? And though a man may prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to the throne, though his own kingdom had been born poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. And there was no end to all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who came later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and a striving after the wind.
If you're joining us today, you are jumping in on a series that we've been going through. It's been looking for maturity beyond the meaningless, as we've looked in Ecclesiastes. We keep turning back to, and we've just been working through pretty much chapter by chapter. And I want to start by just telling you a story about our preparation for our Lao team. But our Lao team been thinking about cultures and entering into another culture, and thinking particularly about cultural values and whether our culture values youth or whether it values wisdom and other things. And one of the little fun exercises we did to see which you value more out of youth and wisdom is if you're stuck in a situation, you can only save one other person. Is it going to be the one-year-old that you save, or is it going to be the 90-year-old that you save? Okay, so have a think about that, the one-year-old and the 90-year-old. Some people would look at the situation and think, well, the one-year-old, they probably wouldn't live much they'll be lucky to live to two. And they might say, well, you know, you should actually go with the 90-year-old. There's 90 years of wisdom there. You don't want to lose it. And we need to learn from it. Others would think, well, the 90-year-old, they kind of live their life, and we should actually let the young one live, and we'll take the one-year-old. What do you choose? Quickly tell the person next to you. What do you choose? Okay, in Australian culture, I think we'd all say the one-year-old, right? Because we value youth. But in another culture, they'd say, come on, this, you know, you're lucky to live past, through those young ages, to get to 90 and hold all that wisdom. We need to keep that in our community. Australians' culture is very different, and we looked at Australian versus Asian culture, and we're probably, our culture would say we love youth, okay? We love young people, and we would focus on that, and we'd pick the one-year-old. That's pretty much because we're an individualistic society who loves, that worships young things, young people. And we're contradictory, I suppose, in a way, if you say you'd save the one-year-old, because in another breath, we're happy to actually terminate, in some states, up to full term. So it's a bit contradictory, aren't we? But that individualistic thinking, comes even from that right to choose. We think that an individual should have the right to choose that. Because we're an individualistic society. Some other countries are more communal culture. You know, you can have a look, it's just if you drove down the road and you looked how many people are in the car, right? How many people are in other cars? Often it's just one or two, you know, go to other countries. How many people are in the car? As many as you can fit, plus more on the roof. You know, if you're in our culture and you get on a plane, what is everyone doing? Well, they're not really talking to each other. Everyone's got their own individual little device and we're doing our own little individual thing. So we have the Western culture, which is very different to our Asian culture, Australian versus Aussie. And in the Western culture, we're probably, I'd say, extremely, almost off the scale, individualistic. My question then is, well, what do we lose from that? What do we lose by being an individualistic culture? And here's my take-home for today. So if you didn't miss everything, just wake up now, and then you can go to sleep after this 1 minute. My take-home today is actually from Ecclesiastes 4, 7 to 12, and it's this, that you're created for community. You are created for community. That's the take-home today. You got it? Have you got it?
Yes.
Got it? Get it? Good. That's what they say, isn't it, school? Got it? Get it? Good. How much do you value that? How much do you believe that you're created for community? How much do you live into that? Is what we're challenged to think about. I'd suggest that your best help is going to come from a community. You know, when you fall or people fall into a ditch in their life, a pit, the best help they're going to get is from a community. Yeah? When people need healing, the best healing that they're going to get is from a community. The warmth that they can get from a community. When there's a tragedy or something that happens in their life and they're looking for emotional healing, the warmth that they can get is from community. And the best hope that people can get is from a community, a Christian community, to give them hope in the face of what is happening in their life. And the best maturity, and we've been thinking about maturity for the whole year, 2019, that's kind of been our umbrella thing. The best maturity will happen in what? In community. Thanks, you're catching it with me. You can all go home now. In community. They say it takes a village to raise a... That's right. Okay, our world is catching on this. But it actually takes a community to raise a Christian. It takes a community to raise a Christian. That's a community that helps grow and nurture and build you up. It takes a church to mature a Christian. And that's why we have big gathering here together. And we try to do it multi-generational sometimes. Last week, we were all in together around tables. That was fun, wasn't it? We had smoke machines for those who weren't here. Ask someone else about the smoke machines. That's all my son remembered. We have small group context where we call our life groups living in faith community every day because we believe it's important. The college that I went to, Moore Theological College, valued community and communal learning so much that they made you live in community for 2 years as you studied. It was required of you to live in 2 years because they believed that was so important. And Ecclesiastes, we have a teacher here. Hebrew name is Qohelet. And the teacher gathers a community around and they learn in community as he speaks to the community. And this is kind of his life findings that we find out here. And if you want to know the end of the story, you've got to get to chapter 12. We started with that. Ecclesiastes 4. Open in the middle of the Bible. Ecclesiastes 4 is... And my top tip for today is that Ecclesiastes is both poetic in parts, but it's also proverbial in parts. So it's poetic in, and we saw this last week, particularly in chapter 3, and it's no strange thing that it is really, because when you think about poetry and song, and you think about Solomon, who knew how many songs? 1,000, plus he added 5. Thought he needed a 5 extra. 1,005 songs he knew. And he knew 3,000 proverbs. So it's no wonder that it is poetic and it's proverbial in parts. It's got witty, wise sayings and observations about life and observing and summarizing life. That is, that's how it's proverbial. and it's also poetic. And we kind of, as we looked at this in leadership, that even came out in our kind of little communal time, that it has these two aspects to it. In chapter 3, you see this. You know, there's a time for this, a time for that. It's very poetic in how it goes, yeah? And there's even those songs we saw from the Seekers, from the Birds. Peter, Paul and Mary, I think, sang that song. Everyone seemed to sing that song in those days. Of there's a time. Turn. Chapter 4. And I'll quickly run you through chapter 4 and show you how this works as well. 1 to 4, you see it starts off with prose, I and these things, but also poetic in a way. And it makes this observation about oppression in our world. It's sick and a sad world we live in. You don't have to look too long to find that out. It actually stopped generations of people, or a generation of people in our country, having children in a way. Because through the Second World War, people got so scared about what was happening in the world that, you know, a lot of that stuff, people didn't want to bring people into the world. Yeah? And so then you have this generation called the what? The baby boomers, right? The baby boomers post-war for about 20 years. And then you go on through the generations, you have that generation, the baby boomers, came from what was called the silent generation. And then before that was the greatest generation. But you don't have to look too far to see and look too far into our history to see that it's not really the most greatest generations, and the silence of the generation means that we had a stolen generation. We have oppression in our own country. We had oppression for decades. It's a stolen generation. Ecclesiastes 4:1 is poetic in the tears and no comfort, the powerless. And then it's proverbial in the way it sums things up, that the oppression comes. And it's from envy. And there's a whole sermon you could talk about that in verse 4. But in verse 5 and 6, as you skim through and bounce through with me, this is a proverbial saying on work. Okay, if you fold your hands, guess what? You go hungry and you don't work. If you use two of your hands too hard, guess what? They fall apart and they fall off. Don't do it. It says it's better that you have one works and one that rests. You have a balance in life, right? It's proverbial in the way that it's talking to us. It's a proverb on work and how to understand work. There's a whole sermon I could say on that too. Do you want me to tell you it? No, we won't go there. We'll stick to what we've got today. Okay. I'm sticking with verses 7 to 12, and that's going to be the focus of today, that you are what? Created for community. Excellent. Created for community, and you'll mature best in community. Now, if you skip down and look to verse 13 and verse 16, it starts kind of in a proverb, an observation about youth, and it ends kind of in a proverb when it talks about vanity. And that word vanity that keeps coming up, the meaninglessness. And Tim reminded us last week in Hebrew, Hebel, and it means the smoke, and it means the mist. It's disappearing. It's vanishing in that regard. It's not enduring. And it ends in that very poetic way of saying, you know, what's verse 16? It's a striving after the wind, a chasing after the wind. It's kind of a proverbial poetic way tying it together. But as I said, I'm just going to focus in on created for community, verses 7 to 12. And you may say, as you look at that, two is a couple, not community. And that's probably why it's quite famous at weddings, right? This one gets a good run at weddings. I'll read verses 9 to 12 to you and read it with me. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has no other to lift him up. Again, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But who can keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Now, I was curious. My wife has this engraved on her wedding band. And I was curious, as I read back over and thought of this, did my wife just want me to warm her up pick her up or to make a buck. So I considered that for a little while, and she can tell me later. But the context, and it's strange that this is really read out at weddings in a way, because the context, what does it start off with? It's about oppression. It's pretty sad and sorry kind of context, isn't it? It's not really wedding material, wedding-worthy passage. The immediate context. If you go in a little bit wider, you might say, well, maybe it fits. There's a time for everything. A time to cry. There's a bit of tears at wedding. A time to dance. There's a bit of dancing at wedding. If you go back to chapter 2, you might say it fits a little bit more. Because in chapter 2, it tells us there to eat, drink, and be satisfied. But it's a little bit of a strange one when you think about the context of it, isn't it? It's not the most uplifting, not the most joyous at times. But maybe it's realistic for marriage, isn't it? It takes energy and it takes work. It's a realistic view of it. Do you believe two are better than one? Okay, do you believe it when you've got half a litre of your gourmet ice cream in your hand and you're having a little hankering for your favourite ice cream? Two is better than one. Maybe you're thinking otherwise. Two is better than one because it's half the sugar, right? Yeah. But the whole idea here is isolation and individualism is not good. Two is better. Two is the smallest community of two coming together. It's not suggesting being unmarried or single is not an option. I don't think the scriptures are saying that. And if you look at the New Testament, it's clear about that. But community is especially important to those that of us are single as well. Especially important. And there is a group of people gathering at Camp Cornonia on the long weekends. It's for young adults who are single. And it's interesting, Koinonia, what does it mean? Fellowship. It means community. And Drew from Lismore is trying to gather people and encouraging people who are in that situation to gather together over the long weekend. But we are created for community. Doesn't mean that you can't enjoy a little bit of time to yourself either, but it just means don't stay there. And don't isolate yourself and remain in that space. But let's have a look, starting from verse 7, because we find out that there's futility of isolation. And there's a picture in the two verses, verses 7 and 8, which show us this. It paints a picture of isolation. And this is directly contrast to the culture that it's written into, to a Jewish culture. Verse 7, again, I saw vanity under the sun. One person who had no other, neither son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with his riches, so that he never says, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is a vanity and an unhappy business. Starts off verse 7, that's a word that goes through the book all the time, meaningless or vanity. The temporary nature of things vanishing and disappearing. Why? Why is isolation that? Because if you go back to the beginning of the Bible, and Genesis 2 will tell us that it is not good for what? That's right. We were created, and we were created in the image of the Creator. That means by making, we are made up, and in our DNA is to be in community. Because as we look at God in his own image, we see, if you go to Genesis 1, it says, famously says, let us. Let us. In Genesis 1:26. Have a look at it sometime. Now, this isn't the lettuce, the frilice, or the iceberg, that famous lettuce. This is the lettuce plurals. This is the let us talking about the Trinitarian God, the coexistence of relationship in Father, Son and Spirit. Made in his image means that we are relational by definition and it's in our DNA. It's not good for Adam to be alone, right? Isolated, alone. And I'm glad those ladies are reading In His Image, that book that they're studying and coming together to talk about next Sunday. in the image of the community God, Father, Son, and Spirit, and would do well to spend more time considering how the Godhead, three in one, interacts, interplays, and how that works. Because the thing is, not long after Genesis 1, where we see that, Genesis 2, Genesis 3, we see the fall. And we see man fall out of relationship with God. We see isolation happen. Isolated from God, outside the garden, isolate, and then there's separation and there's division between the two, between other. But the good news is that Jesus came to bring us back into community with God. You know, the cross is like this, with God and with one another. With God and with one another. Reconcile us to God and reconcile us to one another. But verse 8, in a Jewish culture, a communal culture where they have festivals, where they have feasts, the Passover, they have a law that is thinking communally, and they just have life which deals and thinks about how to operate as a community. Culturally, to not have a brother or to not have a son, that is a death sentence to your livelihood or your business. Because what did a son do? Sons took the work on and continued on the work. What did a brother do? Well, if the husband died, they took on the wife and they took on the business as well. So that was God's way of social security, community built in to design. And that's why when the sons of Zebedee, James and John, leave their father and his fishing business, that's radical, right? And when they move from him, that's radical. But the picture that we get here is isolation of a worker even that is so stuck in the work, they don't even have time to think about, why am I doing this? What's all this toil for and who's it for? And if Satan wants one thing, he wants to isolate you and get you on your own. He wants to take you out of community, just like he struck when the Lord Jesus was isolated and on his own. In Man to Man, some of us men, about a dozen of us have been doing, thinking about the problem of isolationism and the need for interdependence. And so, man, I say to you now, and here's a point of application. Man, if you want to give me eye contact. Men, identify when you are isolating and doing your man cave business. We need to identify and notice in ourselves when we're man caving. Now, ladies, help us out here. Ladies, when you see us do that, just remind us that you're actually man caving. And help remind us of that. And all of us need to look out for individuals who are isolating themselves or are being isolated, yeah? Because isolationism is a true form of what? It's a form of torture. And sadly, in the mental health epidemic that we have in our country, what do we do to people who are struggling really badly with mental health? We put in an isolation unit. It's pretty much the worst thing you can do for them. Isolated by themselves, alone. Just when people need... Just when, and you've been there, and people in here have been there. Just when you need community. Just when you need community. There's futility when we're outside of God's design. Futility when we're outside of God's design. An ABC reporter wrote in an ABC Life article in November 2018. Her name is Grace. I don't know if she's a Christian. Grace Jennings. And the title of the article is this: feeling isolated as a question? You're not alone. That's why one in four of us is lonely. Experts are warning that there's a loneliness epidemic and it could be our next public health crisis. Now, it's not just in older generation. You know, you might think it's the baby boomers. They're getting old, people are dying off and their friends, and they're getting lonely and isolated. The doctor, or one of the doctors who's quoted in that article, suggests that it's actually younger people, 16 to 25, the millennials. The millennials. And it also quoted in there that many of us, including young people, who appear popular and connected, lack strong, meaningful relationships to enrich our lives. And so what I want you to do right now is I want you to pray. I want you to pray for people you know who might be struggling with isolation. And I want you to pray that God this week will use you and put you in the life of someone who is feeling alone and isolated. Please take the time to do that. I'm going to give you space to do that right now. Father, there's people who are isolated and lonely souls whom we can share community with, and we ask that those people that you have put on our hearts today, we may reach out to. And Lord God, we want to be willing to step into lives of those that you connect us with this week. And we ask you that you put those people in our life that we may share you and this community with them. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Quickly to finish off, verse 9 to 12, which I read, we see the beauty of community. The beauty of community is a vision which is contrasted to that earlier picture that we saw in verses 7 and 8. And the church is a community and has an opportunity to connect others to the community, to our community, to God's community, who you created to be. Now, you can't find meaning by yourself because we're not made for that. We're made actually for interdependence. And we need to stop teaching, and this is for parents, stop teaching our kids to be independent. We need to teach them to be interdependent. Okay? Depend on other people. Community that we are here needs to be our community as a church within the community that we live in, right? And we can be that. And when it is, it's actually beautiful because we can help people that find themselves in that ditch that it talked about. The ditch, whether they're in a marriage crisis or a mental health crisis, they need a community to help them when you're in the ditch. When you need healing and life gets emotionally cold or numb and you get numb, you know, the cold nights, you need a community that will help to warm you up and together around you. Men to Men is helping do that. Freedom Prayer helps do that. But you need hope as well. Life gets hopeless when you're fighting on your own. We need others in the community to bring hope and stand around you and fight with you. And there's those in our community here who are facing serious sickness to need us to stand around them and remind them of the hope that we have in Jesus. Fellowship is a beautiful thing. Koinonia, that camp, Koinonia, it's named after. When fellowship is rich, it's amazing, right? When it's not, it is bad, yes. But don't let the past and those things stop you, and don't let Satan use those things to stop you gathering in community and being with Jesus' community. Because verses 9 to 11, we see that community leads to reward. You may be in the pit, but you have a friend to face it with you and to help pull you out of that pit. You may get cold and dark nights, but there's someone to partner with you, to warm you. There may be enemies awaiting, but there's another to stand there and fight alongside and with you. Individualism is foolishness. And our lives are destined to be broken. You end up in the pit to dig and try to dig yourself out of. You end up in unrelentless cold nights and the lonely battle. That's the pits, right? But in community, our lives are stronger and they're enduring. They're, verse 12, they're like the three-chord strand, yeah? This is the picture that we get when God steps into our life. Verse 12 is a great little illustration because verse 12 says a three-chord strand is not easily broken. And I'll tell you quickly this story. Tim, in the little journey with Jay and what's been happening in his life in the last few months, God put it in his heart to send this verse to Jay. Now, ironically, I think it was one night, Tim tells us, while he was in the shower. He's standing and he was actually sitting on the shower, he says, and he was praying, and this verse came to him, and Tim thought, and it's ironic that Tim's underwater while this is all happening. Tim's in the shower and he's thinking, Lord, is that really the verse you want me to send to Jay? And so he did, didn't he? He sent this verse to you. And the great story here, and I just want to share with you now, is how Jay came to be in community with God and relationship with God, and how he restored in his relationship with others and in his marriage.